Welcome, everybody. This is Jim Breeling. Welcome to our session. This is a really special session because our speaker tonight, Kim Grant, was one of the first junior research awardees of the NEA BPT, and with an outstanding clinical trial at McLean Hospital on a group intervention for borderlines who continue to have self-injury, and very intriguing results. By the way, she came to NIMH at my invitation and presented, and looking over her PowerPoint beforehand, everybody I showed to said, "This is fascinating, but it's hopelessly too long for the time." And I told Kim, and she said she could do it. You're certain she could do it. And she did, and it was clear and marvelous and engaging, and people have remarked about that presentation years later. So it's really great now that this is carried on further. One thing I want to mention here before I say some other things about Kim is that if you have questions along the way or at the end of the presentation, send them to neabpd@aol.com. And Kim would really like it if anything's unclear on the way to let us know, and we can raise it. And don't worry about getting typos corrected and so forth. Just say, "Wait a minute, I'm a little confused with this slide 13 or something," so I can flag Kim, and then we can pick up what the concern is. So we can be very responsive to your concern. Kim is from Mississippi, where she is back now as director of the Borderline Personality Disorders Research Clinic and of the BBT Clinic. And it's 10 years from the year of her PhD, and it has been a remarkable 10 years. Her record is one that gives you great hope for the future of the field. As I mentioned, she won one of the early NEA BPD Junior Researcher Award. And the things that she is addressing in her research, emotional dysregulation, the personality traits and processes associated with borderline symptoms in childhood. Think of Jenny McPhee and her presentation in the series in the fall. She's looking at borderline-relevant personality traits and emotional regulation capacity among women and their 12 to 13-year-old children. Emotional regulation is a prospective predictor of sexual revictimization. And by the way, there's good research. Both sexual perpetration and victimization is far from a random occurrence. She has completed recently a major NIMH grant that she's going to be talking about. She's also got her hands in four other enterprises here. She's co-PI with Alex Chapman with a Canadian-funded grant. She's co-PI on an R01 that the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development is funding. She's involved with an R21 from NIDA and an R21 from the Alcohol Institute. So she's a very busy young lady. And she collaborates widely. She has multiple papers that she's co-authored with Tim Troll. She's worked very productively with Italian investigators, and we've already mentioned the Canadian, and she's also had collaboration with Zach Rosenthal and John Conderson, and we're hoping to have Zach Rosenthal on this year with his very intriguing new major R01 on generalizing treatment material to others. I could go on further. I mean, I could really make Kim's cheeks blush, but I don't want to distract from the presentation and the really exciting meat that she's going to give us, so let me stop right here. Kim, it's all yours.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Jim, and I really appreciate the very kind words. And I wanted to welcome everyone and thank you so much for participating in this call this evening. So tonight, as Jim mentioned, what I'm going to be talking with you about is an emotion regulation group we developed to treat self-harm in women with borderline personality. And I'll be telling you a little bit about the group, as well as some of our current research examining its efficacy. So if you'll turn now to the next slide, I wanted to begin by acknowledging my collaborators on this series of studies, Drs. Tull, Gunderson, Lejeune, Romer, and Levy. I also did want to acknowledge both NIMH and the Psychosocial Fellowship of McLean Hospital for funding this research. And I also wanted to orient you to these slides. In particular, you'll notice that in the bottom right-hand corner, you'll see the slide number, and I'm going to be referring to that throughout so that you're able to know exactly what slide I'm discussing. So if you'll turn now to slide 3, I wanted to begin by just giving an overview of self-harm in borderline personality. And when I'm using the term self-harm, I'm referring specifically to behaviors involving the deliberate, direct destruction of body tissue without suicidal intent. So behaviors such as cutting and burning, severe scratching, head banging, any kind of non-suicidal self-injurious behavior. And in addition to the fact that self-harm is incredibly common among folks with borderline personality, this behavior is also associated with a number of negative consequences. There's now a lot of emerging evidence to suggest that self-harm is actually a risk factor for later suicidal behaviors, as well as more severe suicide attempts. This behavior is also one of the things that's been implicated in the high levels of healthcare utilization that we see among patients with borderline personality. And yet, despite all of this, there are actually very few empirically supported treatments for self-harm specifically among individuals with borderline personality. So there are some short-term treatments for self-harm in general, but these have not actually been found to be very effective for folks with borderline personality. There's some evidence to suggest they just don't work. There's some evidence to suggest that they might actually even be iatrogenic to some extent. And even though we do have two larger scale treatments that have been found to be efficacious in the treatment of self-harm within BPD, and I'm referring to here to both dialectical behavior therapy and mentalization-based treatment, these treatments are difficult to implement in a lot of clinical settings due to the extent of their duration and their intensity. Both of these treatments require at least a year-long commitment. They require multiple sessions per week. And so in many areas of the United States, people are not really able to access these treatments, and they're not readily available. And so we thought that given all of this, there was a true need for clinically feasible treatments that specifically targeted self-harm among individuals with BPD. And in particular, we were really interested in developing a brief, non-intensive treatment that could augment the current work already being done in the community by community therapists. Now, in order to actually kind of deliberately and specifically focus or target self-harm in a treatment, behavioral theory suggests that you really need to focus on its underlying mechanisms and its functions, that that's the best way of targeting a behavior efficiently. And as you can see on slide 4, when it comes to self-harm, there is an extensive body of literature suggesting that one of its primary underlying mechanisms is emotion dysregulation. This has been found to be associated with self-harm in a variety of clinical and non-clinical samples, including college students, adolescents in high school, substance users, as well as individuals with borderline personality. And this research really coincides with an extensive body of literature showing that for most individuals, one of the primary functions of self-harm is to avoid, escape, or regulate in some way unwanted emotional distress. So people talk a lot about using self-harm to get relief when they're feeling emotionally overwhelmed. And so what all of this suggested is that if we are seeking to target self-harm directly in a treatment, there might be some benefit of targeting emotion dysregulation, with the basic premise being that if emotion dysregulation actually drives self-harm, then if we decrease an individual's emotion dysregulation, their need for self-harm may decrease as well. And if you'll turn to slide 5, it was based on all of this research that we decided to develop an adjunctive group treatment for self-harm among women with borderline personality. And we really wanted to be able to augment the usual treatment that they were receiving in the community by directly targeting both self-harm and its proposed mechanism of emotion dysregulation. And in terms of how we conceptualize emotion dysregulation from the framework of this treatment, we actually think about it as having several different dimensions. So in terms of our approach to emotion dysregulation, we focus on increasing the awareness, the understanding, and acceptance of emotions, the ability to control one's behaviors when experiencing emotional distress, the flexible use of strategies to modulate emotional arousal, so take the edge off an emotion or reduce its duration rather than trying to just eliminate emotions or avoid them entirely, as well as the willingness to experience distress as part of pursuing meaningful activities in life. And this last dimension, I think, warrants particular attention, because one thing that there's a lot of research to suggest is that if folks are absolutely terrified of negative emotions or unwilling to experience them, their lives are going to have to be incredibly restricted. Most of the things in life that matter to us do come with at least the possibility of experiencing a negative emotion. We might be anxious about something, or the possibility of disappointment. So if we are absolutely unwilling to experience a negative emotion, our life has to be incredibly small. And in and of itself, this could absolutely increase emotional distress as people are not living lives of meaning or value to themselves. So if you turn to slide 6, what you're going to see on this slide is an outline of the content of our group across its 14 weeks. And I was just going to take a moment to briefly comment on each of these weeks. So in terms of week 1, what we focus on initially is helping clients identify the function of their self-harm. And we do this for a couple of reasons. One reason is because we do want folks to be able to connect with the fact that their self-harm is serving a purpose, and it is, in fact, helping them meet some basic human needs. And this, we think, might help target some of the shame that often goes along with self-harm when people think that, you know, they're doing it because they're crazy or there's something wrong with them. And connecting with the fact that this is actually serving an important purpose can help with that. We also generally find that at the end of this session, most clients are connecting with the fact that oftentimes their self-harm is being used in an effort to avoid or escape negative emotions. And so this kind of leads into the rest of the group. Now, in terms of week 2, we start talking about the function of emotions. And in this week, we really provide psychoeducation to folks about what emotions do for us, the fact that they're hardwired in, they provide information, that they really do have great utility in helping people be more effective in their lives. And the hope with this is that we can start increasing emotional acceptance by letting people know the benefits of having emotions. Weeks 3 through 6 focus on helping clients gain emotional awareness and clarity. So throughout these 4 weeks, we're really helping folks identify their emotions, differentiate between different emotional states, put a label on their emotions, and we're also helping people to identify differences between emotions that occur directly in response to something that's happened, that are perhaps very proportionate to something that just happened, versus emotions that are influenced by other factors that are not occurring in the present moment. So being exhausted, having not eaten for 2 days, having had a really negative experience a few days ago that somebody has not actually processed through or attended to. These types of things that to some extent might actually increase emotional reactivity or the intensity of the emotions that one experiences. In weeks 7 through 8, we focus a lot on helping people connect experientially with the problems associated with efforts to avoid their own emotions. So we have people reflect on both the short-term and the long-term consequences of efforts to fight or control or avoid different emotions, and really seeing that perhaps these efforts are not working in the long term. And then we introduce our alternative to fighting one's emotions, which is being willing to experience emotions, which is not at all the same as, you know, really wanting them to be there, but more of a pragmatic, if an emotion is there, it may be more effective to just take it as it is and move forward rather than trying to get rid of it. And so there's a lot of experiential exercises in these weeks. Week 9 focuses on teaching people healthy, non-avoidant strategies for modulating emotions, so ways of taking the edge off of an emotion or distracting from an emotion for enough time that it's able to kind of reduce in intensity a bit, and yet not having to resort to unhealthy strategies. Week 10 focuses on basic behavioral impulse control strategies, so basically just skills for resisting urges to engage in self-harm and not acting in impulsive ways. And then finally, weeks 11 through 14 are aspects of this treatment that draw heavily from acceptance and commitment therapy. And these 4 weeks really help focus on identifying where people want to move forward in their lives, like what is important to the person, how they want to get there, and how they'd like to move their lives forward. And the reason we believe that this is particularly important is because it helps augment the treatment so that people aren't just focusing on what they're trying to get away from or what they're trying to reduce, but they're focusing on where they want to go and what direction they want to move in their lives, which I think is a really nice way of ending the treatment.
Kim, I have a request if you could speak a little bit louder or maybe closer to the microphone or both.
Let me see if I do it this way, if this will be better. So please let me know if this actually helps with the volume. So if everyone could turn now to slide 7. So prior to the primary trial that I'm going to be talking about tonight, there were 2 studies that provided some support for the utility of this emotion regulation group treatment. So the first was an initial smaller randomized controlled trial that I conducted in Boston at McLean Hospital. And in this smaller RCT, we had a group of women who had borderline personality and recent self-harm, and they were randomly assigned to either continue with their ongoing outpatient therapy or to continue with their outpatient therapy and in addition receive this emotion regulation group. And what we found in this trial is that the addition of this emotion regulation group to their outpatient therapy had positive effects on self-harm and emotion dysregulation, which were our 2 primary outcomes of interest, as well as symptoms of borderline personality, depression, and anxiety. And the reason for this finding seemed to be related to the fact that although people who just continued with their ongoing outpatient treatment showed a fair amount of stability in these measures over the 14-week period, those who were receiving our emotion regulation group actually showed significant improvements over this period on all of the measures of interest. So following this initial RCT...
Kim, can I interrupt for just a second?
Please.
Can we do a check if anyone's having trouble hearing Kim, would you send a note? If we don't hear from you, we'll assume that it's going well. And I also had a question. Is bulimia included within self-injury?
It is not. However, it is considered, and so the reason it's not is because it does not immediately, every time the person engages in the behavior, result in tissue damage. And so for that reason, we think of it as being a related type of self-destructive behavior, but not necessarily automatically self-injurious. However, we do have data in the larger study that I'm going to be talking about where we looked at the effects of this treatment on self-destructive behaviors overall, and that did include eating disordered behaviors of binging and purging.
Good.
So are we good on volume, do we think?
Jim, I got a note that someone still is having trouble.
Oh, okay. This might actually be louder. It's sounding louder in my ear. Okay, I'm going to assume that this worked because it's feeling louder to me. And certainly everyone let us know if you still can't hear me as well.
For me, you're softer now.
Oh, okay. Is this better?
Yes, I think so, Kim. Thanks.
Okay. All right. Following this initial study, we then conducted an open trial, which basically does not have a control group, but simply added on this emotion regulation group to participants' ongoing outpatient treatment. The reason that we considered this open trial an extension is that we were doing this treatment in a much more underserved area with far less access to treatment and among a more diverse population. And what we found is that adding this treatment onto the outpatient treatment they were already receiving, we found significant changes from pre to post treatment in self-harm as well as self-destructive behaviors in general, and that did include behaviors such as disordered eating behaviors, binging and purging behaviors, and emotion dysregulation. We also found the differences in psychiatric symptoms that we had seen previously, as well as some significant improvements in social and vocational impairment. So again, some evidence that there was some usefulness of adding this treatment on to individuals' ongoing outpatient therapy. Now, if you turn to slide 8, another thing that we wanted to do early on in testing this treatment was to examine the extent to which we actually were able to know the mechanism of change in this treatment. So we had developed this treatment thinking that if we helped people modify their emotion dysregulation and decrease their emotion dysregulation, then their self-harm would decrease over time. And we wanted to test this out empirically. And so using our samples from both of the trials that I just discussed, we actually examined if changes in emotion dysregulation mediated or accounted for or explained the changes in self-harm that we saw following completion of this treatment. And so we examined that for the treatment completers in both of our trials, and we compared these individuals to the initial RCT controls who did not receive our treatment. And we estimated these models in M+. And if you turn to slide 9, you will see that we did find evidence for full mediation across both trials, and that is indicated by the standardized mediated effect being significant. And so what this tells us is that there is evidence to suggest that emotion regulation is the mechanism of change in this treatment, that the reason we are seeing these improvements in self-harm is precisely because we are targeting emotion regulation and we are improving that, and it's because of that that the self-harm is improving as well. Now, in terms of the next slide, slide 10, you're going to read a bit or hear a bit about the purpose of the larger study that is going to be the focus of the rest of this talk. And this was a larger scale randomized controlled trial. And the primary purpose of this study was to extend our findings of the original randomized controlled trial. As I noted, those findings were very promising, but the patient population in that study was not terribly diverse. Everyone was white. They were financially secure, and they were also receiving a lot of treatment in the community, on average about 2.5 to 3 hours a week before the emotion regulation group. And so we were really interested in seeing if we could find similar effects in a more socioeconomically and ethnically diverse sample of patients, as well as a much more underserved setting than Boston, which is incredibly not underserved when it comes to psychotherapy. And we were also interested in looking at a wider range of outcomes. So in addition to all of the outcome measures we had used previously, we wanted to expand the assessments that we had to include other self-destructive behaviors. So again, behaviors that we believe increase risk for negative outcomes and are potentially self-damaging, although do not immediately result in tissue damage like self-harm. So behaviors like substance use and suicidal behaviors and eating disordered behaviors and risky sexual behaviors, because there's actually a large body of evidence now suggesting that emotion dysregulation may underlie each of those behaviors as well. So it kind of made sense that this treatment could be useful in targeting those as well. We also wanted to expand our measures to look at measures of adaptive functioning. And so, you know, we really wanted to see if in addition to decreasing some of this stuff, we could actually have an impact on areas such as interpersonal functioning, social and vocational impairment, and overall quality of life. So on slide 11, you'll see our primary aims and hypotheses. And the primary aim of this study was simply to examine the efficacy of this treatment in a larger study, as well as to examine the extent to which the treatment gains we found were able to be maintained over a 9-month follow-up period. And this is particularly important because even though up until this study we had found that people were showing improvements over the course of treatment, we didn't know what was happening once the treatment had ended, and we were hopeful that these gains would be maintained, but you know, it was certainly possible without testing this empirically that following the end of treatment, people could potentially fall back into old patterns or habits. And so we really wanted to see what would happen over a 9-month follow-up. And so to do this, we had a group of women who had borderline personality who were randomly assigned to receive this emotion regulation group in addition to whatever ongoing outpatient therapy they had, or to continue with their outpatient therapy alone for a 14-week period. So this was our waitlist group. At the end of that 14 weeks, then they received the treatment as well. And what we expected is that, like the other research we had done, that adding this emotion regulation group to participants' ongoing outpatient therapy would have positive effects on all of the outcomes of interest that we were studying. So on slide 12, you'll see our inclusion and exclusion criteria, and I want to note that we were trying with these criteria to make our sample as broad and generalizable as possible. We really wanted to see what would happen by having as few inclusion and exclusion criteria as possible. So we required participants to be women between the age of 18 and 60. They had to have a history of repeated self-harm with at least one episode in the past 6 months, and this was done just to ensure that self-harm was still an ongoing concern. We also required that all participants have some form of individual therapy. And in the past, we had really required that folks have an individual therapist they were meeting with weekly. But because the setting in which we're conducting this study does not normally offer that type of therapy, we extended our criteria to include any individual contact on a semi-regular basis. So it could be a therapist, it could be a psychiatrist, it could also be a case manager. And finally, we opened up this study to participants who had sub-threshold borderline personality, primarily because there's a lot of evidence to suggest that even sub-threshold BPD is associated with a significant amount of impairment. And again, we were trying to reach as many people as possible. Exclusion criteria we kept to a minimum, because, again, we wanted to open this up to as many folks as possible. So the only exclusion criteria we had were primary psychotic disorder, bipolar 1, and then past month substance dependence, although we certainly had folks who had current substance abuse and substance dependence outside of the past month. So if you turn to slide 13, you're going to see the demographics of our final sample across the treatment condition and then the waitlist condition. And so the treatment condition is the ERGT plus treatment as usual. And if you turn to slide 14, what you'll see is highlighted the fact that we did a pretty good job of increasing sample diversity. So this sample was relatively low SES and much more ethnically diverse. Now, if you turn to slide 15, you'll see the clinical characteristics of our sample. And even though we did open up this group to folks who had subthreshold BPD, you'll actually see on the first line that the vast majority of our sample met full DSM criteria for BPD. And if you turn to slide 16, you'll see highlighted the fact that this is, in fact, I think, a representative BPD sample. So there were high rates of suicide attempts, fairly low global assessment of functioning scales scores, suggesting that these folks really were struggling in multiple domains. And if you turn to slide 17, you'll see that the participants in our sample were not receiving extensive outpatient therapy before this group. So in the treatment condition, they were actually receiving less than an hour of individual therapy every week. And in the waitlist condition, they were receiving about 1 hour of individual therapy. So this was far lower than what we had observed in the initial RCT. Now, if you turn to slide 18, you'll see the diagnostic data for our sample, both in terms of lifetime Axis 1 conditions and current Axis 1 and 2 disorders. And slide 19 really highlights the fact that the folks in our sample, as with many people who have borderline personality, were struggling with a number of different conditions in addition to BPD. So current rates of Axis 1 disorders were above 50%. There was extensive Axis 2 comorbidity. So these folks definitely were struggling with a number of different difficulties. So slide 20 shows you our outcome measures. And to begin, we included two measures, one of self-harm and one of other self-destructive behaviors. So the deliberate self-harm inventory assesses the frequency of self-harm over specified time periods. And the self-harm inventory looks at the past month frequency of a variety of self-destructive behaviors, including drug and alcohol abuse, risky sex, disordered eating, and suicidal behaviors. And so both of those were things that we thought this treatment may be able to target. We also included two measures of emotion dysregulation and avoidance. The Difficulties in Emotion Regulation Scale assesses emotion dysregulation across six dimensions, and those dimensions actually map on to the ones that I mentioned at the very beginning of this talk when describing the group. And then we also use the Acceptance and Action Questionnaire to assess the tendency to avoid unwanted internal experiences, particularly emotions. Slide 21 shows you the measures that assessed psychiatric symptoms. So in order to assess BPD symptoms, we had two measures. One was a clinician-administered instrument that looks at changes in BPD symptoms over time, and this is the ZAN-BPD. And then we also used the borderline evaluation of severity over time to look at past month self-reported BPD symptoms. We use the Beck Depression Inventory to assess current depression symptoms and the Depression, Anxiety, and Stress Scales to assess separate symptoms in those domains. And if you look at slide 22, you will see our measures of adaptive functioning, and we had three of these measures. So first of all, we use the BPD composite of the Inventory of Interpersonal Problems, and this assesses interpersonal problems thought to be very relevant to borderline personality, including interpersonal sensitivity and aggression and other things that people have found to be associated with BPD. We also looked at social and vocational impairment due specifically to psychological difficulties. And we looked at the quality of life inventory. And what's important about this measure is that it assesses an individual's satisfaction with life in areas that they specifically identify as being important to themselves. And so it really is looking at very relevant life satisfaction. And all of the outcome measures that I mentioned were administered both pre- and post-treatment or waitlist, as well as pre- and post-treatment for the folks in the waitlist condition who later received the treatment, and then also 3 and 9 months after completing the treatment. And if you move to slide 23, you'll just see some basic preliminary analyses. One thing to note is that the overall treatment dropout rate from the emotion regulation group was 24%. This is slightly higher than the initial RCT findings from that first study we did. It's probably about average for BPD treatment outcome research, so you know, something that's probably in the range of expected. Also, in terms of the demographic, clinical, and diagnostic variables that I showed you earlier, there were no significant between-group differences on any of those characteristics, with one exception. Prior to receiving the emotion regulation treatment, there were significantly higher levels of treatment as usual among our treatment as usual waitlist group. They just happened to be getting a larger amount of hours per week of therapy in the community. And the benefit of this just happening to work out this way is that when we included the 1.5 hours of treatment time associated with our emotion regulation group, then there were no significant differences in the overall amount of therapist contact time across these groups. Now, slide 24 shows you the way in which we examined our treatment effects and compared the treatment and waitlist conditions. And basically what we did for this is use latent growth models, which model changes from pre to post values on all of our measures, and then they model condition, so treatment or waitlist, as influencing the changes in these measures. And the other important thing to note is because of the ways in which missing data are handled in these models, it allows us to use the intent to treat sample, which is something that is considered kind of standard for looking at the efficacy of a treatment. And slide 25 shows you just an overview of the primary findings, but I'm actually going to go through and show you figures to represent these. But overall, what we found is that there were significant effects of our treatment associated with medium to large effect sizes on self-harm and other self-destructive behaviors, emotion dysregulation, BPD symptoms, and depression and stress symptoms, and quality of life. And so if you'll turn to slide 26, we're going to show you a series of figures of these results. And all of these are set up pretty much the same. And so just to orient you, the treatment condition is in green. The waitlist condition is in red. And what you would like to see, or at least what I would like to see in all of these slides, is for scores to be going down, with one exception that I'll note when we get to it. And so you can see here the findings for self-harm. Waitlist condition remained pretty stable, and our treatment condition showed decreases in self-harm. If you turn to slide 27, these are the results for self-destructive behaviors. Again, decreases over time in the treatment condition and a slight increase in these behaviors in the waitlist condition. Slide 28 shows the findings for emotion dysregulation, and now you're going to start to see some very similar patterns where the waitlist condition is remaining relatively stable over the 14-week period, and our treatment condition is showing significant decreases in this measure. Slide 29 shows the results for experiential avoidance. I do want to note, however, that even though this effect size was medium to large, and the figure certainly looks a lot like the others I've shown you, this was not a significant treatment effect. It just approached significance. Slide 30 shows the results for BPD symptoms on the clinician-administered assessment, And you can see here again, there were decreases for the treatment group in BPD symptoms and relative stability for our waitlist group. Slide 31 shows self-reported BPD symptoms. This was not a significant treatment effect, probably because both groups reported some decrease in these symptoms. And we see a similar pattern for depression symptoms on slide 32, where on the Beck depression inventory, both groups are reporting some decreases, and this was not a significant treatment effect. Slide 33, however, shows our other measure of depression symptoms, and here we do see significant between-group differences. Slide 34 shows the results for anxiety symptoms, where there was no treatment effect and very little change in anxiety in either group. Slide 35 shows our results for stress symptoms, where we did see significant between-group differences. Slide 36 shows a similar pattern of findings for interpersonal problems, although again, even though it looks like these are showing a similar pattern, this was not a significant treatment effect, it just approached significance. Slide 37 shows our findings for social and vocational impairment, and interestingly, this is one where we also did not see a significant treatment effect, probably because participants in both conditions actually showed improvements in social and vocational impairment over the 14-week period. And finally, slide 38 shows our findings for quality of life. And this was the one slide I mentioned was going to differ, that actually in order to see improvements, we want to see quality of life increasing, so the line going up. And another thing to note about this is scores on this measure actually can range from negative to positive. And you can see at pre-treatment, so the start of the study, both our treatment and waitlist conditions had scores on this measure in the negative range, suggesting fairly poor quality of life. However, after treatment, not only did the quality of life improve for participants who received the emotion regulation group, they actually became positive. So that shows that there were some substantial improvements in quality of life for our treatment condition.
Now, what would be examples that one would say were that showed up? What changes showed up in the quality of life improvement, kind of specific type of things?
So what this looks at is there are several domains of quality of life on this measure. So we ask people about the extent to which certain domains matter to them, and then the extent to which those domains that matter actually are satisfying to them. And so it's things like personal relationships with family, friendships, work, school, social and kind of, kind of fun activities, pleasurable events, hobbies, any kind of area of life you could think of. And within each of those, we ask, is this important to you? And if it is, we ask, is this something that is actually satisfying to you? Or, in fact, are you having, or do you believe that it is not at all where you want it to be? And so to see these changes would suggest that folks are, for those areas that they believe are important, they are increasingly satisfied with those areas. And so they feel like these things are helping them more. Does that answer? Okay. So I'm hoping that answers the question, but certainly feel free to let me know if it did not. So in terms of slide 39, what you're going to see here is the model we use to look at the extent to which gains that are maintained or that are achieved during the treatment or during the course of treatment are actually maintained after the treatment ends for a 9-month follow-up period. And these analyses are really similar to the ones we did initially with a couple of exceptions. So first is the case that we modeled this for all participants who ever began our emotion regulation group. And so this is for participants in the treatment condition and those in the waitlist condition who later received the treatment. And because we expect that there's going to be differences in the extent to which all of these outcomes change during treatment and after treatment, we actually model this in two separate stages. So first are changes during treatment, and then the second slope is changes from post-treatment through the nine-month follow-up period. And so if you turn to slide 40, you'll see that the first set of findings is simply that, similar to the initial findings I reported for participants in the treatment group, across the entire set of participants who began our emotion regulation group, we did see significant improvements across the treatment period on all outcome measures. Most importantly, though, we also found that all of these gains were either maintained or further improved upon at the nine-month follow-up. And so you'll see additional significant improvements throughout the follow-up period for really most of our primary outcomes of interest: self-harm, emotion dysregulation, experiential avoidance, BPD symptoms, and quality of life. And for the other outcome measures, what we found was stability during this post-treatment and follow-up period, which I think suggests that these gains were maintained. And again, I'm just going to show you some figures representing these on the next set of slides. So if you turn to slide 41, this is actually the observed means for self-harm. So this is not transformed data that we use for the analyses. This is actually our reported means, just to give you a sense of what the true data were for self-harm. And again, you can see that there was relative stability, if not some improvements, in the follow-up period at the bottom of the figure. Now, if you turn to slide 42, these are the results using the transformed variable that we use for the statistical analyses. And again, you'll see improvements during the treatment phase and then further improvements during the follow-up period. The next slide, 43, shows changes for self-destructive behaviors, where you see stability during the follow-up period. Slide 44 shows changes for emotion dysregulation, where you'll see further significant improvements during the follow-up period after post-treatment.
Kim, yes. On the self-harming and the destructive behavior, are the numbers on the vertical scale the number of incidents or?
Yes.
The number of incidents.
Yes. Thank you very much for that question. Yeah, on the observed means for self-harm and the results for self-harm inventory, those are the reported frequencies of that behavior. For self-harm, it's in the past 3.5 months. So if you look at pre on slide 41, if you look at the pre, it says about 50. That's 50 episodes in that prior 3.5 month period. If you go to slide 43 for the self-harm inventory, that's the frequency of these behaviors in the past month period.
Busy little people.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. So 45 shows the results for experiential avoidance. And I'll give you a second to get there. And again, what we're seeing is continued improvements during the follow-up period.
Can I interrupt you again? The difficulties in emotional regulation scale, what would be a score in the, quote, normal range?
Ah, well, we're actually going to get to that toward the end. But in terms of the score, what I can tell you is that you'd want to see somewhere between a 75 and 80 to be at college students, basically, which I think we would.
Okay, so they're getting close then.
Yeah, very close.
Good. Okay.
So slide 46 shows the BPD symptom severity scores on the clinician-administered measure. So again, nice stability during the follow-up period. Slide 47 shows the results for self-reported BPD symptoms, where they actually continue to report improvements during that period. Slide 48 shows the results for depression, where you see stability. And you see similar findings on slide 49 for the other measure of depression. similar findings on slide 50 for our measure of anxiety symptoms, and similar findings on slide 51 for our measure of stress symptoms.
And where would normal range be on the depression?
Oh man, that is a darn good question. I don't even know. I think it's below 12.
Okay, so they're like 50% above on that, and okay.
And again, we'll speak to the number of people who actually hit normal range in general.
Oh, okay.
And that might actually help with some of this.
Yes. I'm just trying to pick up things as people are.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So let me see, and hopefully this other slides will speak to some of this. So slide 52 is interpersonal problems. Slide 53 shows social and vocational impairment. And again, in both of these, we just saw stability during this follow-up period. And then in a slide that I love, slide 54 shows our improvements for quality of life. And again, what you can see are improvements during the treatment period and then further significant improvements during the follow-up period. And again, given the way in which we end our group with 4 weeks focused on helping people identify the directions they want to move in their lives, these findings for quality of life are particularly important to us. So if you'll turn to slide 55, the next thing that we wanted to actually speak to is the clinical significance of our findings. And there is extensive discussion in the literature on treatment outcomes or treatment outcome research about the importance of looking at clinical significance. Statistical significance is incredibly important. It's imperative to demonstrating the efficacy of treatments. But in the end, we really, I think, kind of care more about whether or not these changes are actually having a meaningful impact on people's lives than we care about the extent to which their scores on a measure change 2 points, which, you know, may or may not actually mean anything to their lives. So in order to determine clinical significance, there are 2 criteria that have to be met. The first is that we want a participant to actually report a statistically reliable improvement in their symptoms. We want them to be reporting a reliable change in their symptoms. We also, and I think this goes to Jim's questions, want them to reach normal levels of functioning. I mean, that is the point of having these treatments, that eventually we would like folks to not be suffering anymore and to actually be functioning at a normal level. So if you turn to slide 56, and I acknowledge that this is a very dense slide, but I'm going to walk you through it. These are our clinical significance findings, both at post-treatment, so the very end of treatment, and then at the end of the 9-month follow-up period. And what's important to note on this slide is if you turn to slide 57, you'll see that at the end of our 14-week treatment, approximately 1/3 of the participants who received the treatment had clinically significant effects for emotion dysregulation and emotional avoidance, BPD symptoms, and interpersonal functioning. So about 1/3 of our sample had shown a reliable improvement and reached normal levels of functioning on these measures. And then if you turn to slide 58, you'll see that these outcomes continue to improve during the follow-up period because at the end of the follow-up period, about 1/2 of the participants who had received our treatment had clinically significant effects on these measures. And so again, what this would suggest is 9 months from the end of this treatment, about 1/2 the participants who received it were functioning at a normal level. Certainly, you know, we hope to continue to research this until we can get those percentages even higher, and yet for a 14-week group, this is pretty promising. Now, in terms of the next slide, 59, you'll see our effort to quantify the change that these folks experienced in their self-harm and other self-destructive behaviors. And when thinking about clinical significance of these, what we really want to see is a dramatic reduction in the frequency of these behaviors. And eventually, we would like to see abstinence from self-harm. We do not believe going into the treatment that abstinence is expected immediately. It is not something that in order to be in the treatment, people cannot have a lapse. We think that would actually be iatrogenic. But we do hope that eventually they'll be able to abstain from self-harm. And so if you look at the top part of the slide, what you can see is that more than 50% of our participants who received this treatment showed a reduction of greater than 70% in the frequency of their self-harm and other self-destructive behaviors. So that's a fairly dramatic decrease. I think most importantly to me is that during the second half of the treatment and throughout the entire follow-up period, more than 50% of our participants did abstain from self-harm. So this suggests that for a subset of our participants, they really are able to stop self-harm, at least for 9 months after the end of treatment. Okay, so turn to slide 60. This is just kind of our wrap-up. Overall, the findings from this study really do provide support for the efficacy of this treatment for self-harm, specifically among women with BPD. We found significant treatment effects on really most of our primary outcomes of interest. And we also find evidence to support the fact that these treatment gains were maintained during a 9-month follow-up period. And notably, in the main outcomes of interest, I think the areas that we really target the most in the treatment, we saw continued improvements after treatment in those areas. And so this does provide support that it may be useful to add this group to the treatment being provided by clinicians in the community. One thing to note is that we did not try to match this group to any particular form of individual therapy. We didn't require that community clinicians be providing one type of therapy or that they change what they were doing. And in fact, over 70% of the clinicians in this study who were working with these patients on an individual basis were not providing cognitive behavioral treatment. They were providing supportive or integrative or dynamic treatments, and yet we still found these positive effects. I think it's also important to note that just due to the fact that a lot of folks didn't have regular access to treatment and that in this area, at least, weekly therapy is not the norm. This group ended up being the primary treatment for 43% of participants in our trial. For those participants, they were actually only seeing their other treatment team members once every 3 to 4 weeks. So this really was the primary treatment they were receiving. And again, despite that not necessarily being what we intended, we did find these positive effects. Slide 61 is our last slide, and I just wanted to note that at this point, the only population that we've actually examined this treatment is within women with borderline personality, so we have no idea the extent to which findings are going to generalize to adolescents or men or folks who don't actually have BPD, and I think studies are really needed to examine the extent to which this treatment will be useful in these populations. I think it's also important that we continue to examine the extent to which emotion regulation really is the mechanism of change in this treatment. You know, we have some preliminary work to suggest that, and yet I also believe that it is likely the case that changes in emotion regulation are explaining why we are having positive effects on these other outcomes like BPD and depression and self-destructive behaviors, because all of those have also been proposed to be driven by emotion dysregulation. And yet, I think it's also important to note that there could be other mechanisms of change operating in this treatment, particularly the enhancement of mentalization, which we certainly are providing clients with skills that should enhance mentalization, as well as just general acceptance of internal experiences, which we know from past research to be a key mechanism in other acceptance-based behavioral therapies. So that is it. Thank you very much, and I'm happy to take questions.
Wow, let me. We're tight on time here, hitting our 9 o'clock, but let's see if I can put these together. Wow. Doesn't this show that DBT is very highly treatable?
Absolutely. I believe it completely does, and it really builds on all of the other research showing that if you have a treatment developed for BPD that was actually designed to help these folks, we can see incredible progress in a relatively short period of time.
Yeah, this is all, and particularly the continuing improvements after the end of the group treatment.
Yeah.
That one would have a group treatment for what, 12 weeks?
14.
14 weeks for an hour and a half a session, get that kind of impact and have it increase. Did you get any data of people's contact with therapists during the post-treatment period?
Yes, we do have that data. I have not looked at it extensively, only to know that for most people, they received less treatment during the follow-up period.
Right. One wonders about the nature if having this group treatment affected how they interacted with their therapist.
Oh, yeah, that I'm not sure about. All we have is therapist contact and whether they were still in it, but not anything about the nature of the therapeutic relationship.
Okay, the next question here is, where do we get this?
Mississippi. And I know that's a shocking answer, because when else would you come to Mississippi? Currently, this is, you know, being done in this area, and right now we are the only site providing it, although I have to also say that they are actually going to be looking at this treatment for self-harm outside of BPD throughout Sweden. So relatively soon we should have some data on the extent to which this treatment is helpful for folks who are struggling with self-harm and don't have diagnoses of BPD.
Kim, I've got another question. Oh, boy. Well, you answered the question, is the treatment available in the New York area? You either got to go to Mississippi or you got to go to Sweden right now.
Apparently.
And I, among a number of comments, I've just got to read this one. Kim gets an A double plus in my book for the quality of the annotation of the slides. Really good teaching technique, keeping the focus and good flow. What I call the IV drip approach. The pace allows assimilation of ideas, let alone the value and hope her research accords.
Wow, thank you very much.
So you really hit a chord, and let's see, I think I'll go into the travel business of booking trips to Mississippi. For a deluge of patients coming in, better than the, well, the Freedom Riders got put in jail. Well, that was Alabama, I guess. But maybe they'd be, maybe borderlines would be welcome in Mississippi these days.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much. This was just spectacular. I think you really gave a real boost of hope in this, that it just isn't pie in the sky, but here's things hitting the, walking the talk and really having an impact. It gives great hope. So thank you so much for a wonderful presentation.
Oh, no problem. Thank you.
And good luck the rest of the year, and we hope to have you back with a further update.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Kim. Thanks, Kim.
Bye-bye, all, and tune in next week. See you. Have a great week.
Bye-bye.
Bye.